when disaster strikes. Will you be ready?
Good evening, and we begin tonight with the monster hurricane and its deadly impact already.
When all hope is gone, will the government be there for you? If you're looking for ways to take your prepping to the next level, then you've come to the right place. Broadcasting from a secure and well-prepared location, it's time for Prepping 2.0. And now, please welcome authors Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Prepping 2.0. I am your host today, Shelby Gallagher, joined by my co-host, Glenn Tate. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Shelby.
Good to talk to you. We're also, this week's show is exciting. It's very fun to talk about. It's a continuation of our conversation from last week with Special Forces Ted. Special Forces Ted, hello. How are you?
Hey, thanks again for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So a couple things we want to talk about really quick. We'd like to do this at the beginning of the show. We got so excited last week, didn't get a chance to do it, is our tick off on our list of the first 100 things to disappear when the collapse happens. And it's that you can look at that list. We have it on our website at prepping2-0.com. And the next on the list, seasoned firewood. It says here on the website about $100 per cord. Wood takes 6 to 12 months to become dried for home use. So you can imagine in the middle of winter or in the middle of no heat supplies, except for burning combustibles, when you don't have wood, it's going to get cold and it's going to get tricky because you can't just chop down a tree and burn it. It's got to be seasoned. It's got to be dead for a while. Ask people in Venezuela how that's going. There's not a whole lot of natural foliage available. So something to think about in your preps. Do you want to add to that at all, Glenn?
Well, I think a lot of lone wolf preppers out there that really aren't thinking stuff through, and this is some big adventure in their mind as opposed to like practical planning, they probably think, well, there's a lot of trees around. I'll just cut them down and just, you know, burn them and stuff. And they're not seasoned. And then I also remember hearing about Bosnia, and people would take furniture and pianos and very valuable things and chop them up. And I don't know how that turned out for them, but off the top of my head, I'm guessing a piano is like really hardwood with like some additives, some stain and paint, and it probably doesn't burn really well. And so think it through, have the seasoned firewood. This is all about planning and thinking it through and not, you know, having an adventure in your mind. It's about getting stuff done.
Yeah. Very good. So the other thing, and that reminds me too, before we get into talking some more with Special Forces, Ted, again, the ways that you can reach us and find out what we're doing. Prepping2-0.com is our website. Glenn has his author website, 299days.com. You can launch from any of these and go to social media. Specifically on Prepping2-0, you can go pick whatever platform you want to listen to this show. And as always, we want to welcome our listeners in Utah on KYAH and KNAK, Utah's Talk Authority, which is great. My website is agreatstate.com, and I am in the throes of book 3.
I know.
I'm so excited.
We had a great conversation last night. We were driving back. It was a mountain road. It was beautiful. And we were talking about how, you know, the crossover, your books are going to come to Pierce Point, and how Grant Mattson's going to interact with your characters and all this stuff. And I'm not going to tell anybody what it is, but I got energized. It was so cool. It was so cool. I think people are going to like it a lot.
And those are the conversations we call literary agent meetings. And those are really fun. So it's when the creative juices go. So it's great. Cause all of my books are very fresh on my brain because I've been in them so much, and Glenn has not. So it was good to kind of get everybody on the same page. So exciting. Hang in there with me. Okay, Special Forces Ted is with us. Thank you again for joining us. And one of the questions as I was listening to the conversation from last week's show that I wanted to go back to is we were talking about how in collapse situations or in very sparse situations, people become tribal. They start kind of peeling off and joining certain groups. And I think that can be, and we had, and we were talking about that in the context of groups like Antifa and things like that. And that can get kind of concerning, maybe scary for some people. And it's not to, Antifa, yes, concerns me, but it doesn't scare me because I know that there's good tribes and bad tribes. So I wanted to, we talked about it after the show a little bit last week, but talk to us about listeners about that is human nature to gather with like-minded.
Absolutely, Shelby. That's exactly how it is. I think people do it without even realizing they're doing it. People want to be around other like-minded people. And especially during stressful times, you're going to gravitate towards people that think a lot like you and, you know, bring other things to bear as well. As far as tribal situations, I absolutely would recommend do not avoid being part of a tribe or being part of a group. I highly recommend it. Just be aware of tribal dynamics and, the pecking order within tribes and how, everything needs to be established. And, you can look at the models of how groups are formed, the whole Stormy Norman performing thing. If you can, it's best to start your group or your tribe before the crisis happens. That way you can have a lot of things ironed out before you have to do it under stress, if that makes sense.
Right. Oh, I I'm going to agree with you on that. And that's one of the reasons why, and I feel like I'm just a talking commercial right now, but it's true. We, when I say we, Glenn and I are associated and are part of the advisory committee of PrepperNet, which is a huge group nationally. And you can, again, click on it on our website where you can find fellow preppers in your area. That's one of the number one questions we get asked all the time. How do I find others in my area? For this very reason, it's preppers trying to find other preppers so that they can create those small communities that they need. If you talk to Forrest Garvin over at PrepperNet, it is amazing the high level of organized dynamics that he has with his prepper group in his area, they've put together, we would call them bylaws, but they are the, rules of engagement, how we will conduct ourselves when there is a collapse. And it is really inspiring. And I'm just adding that to what you just said, Special Forces, because now is the time to plan those things out and to think those through and to put kind of those sorts of, expected rules of engagement, expected, how people will behave now, because it is, you don't want to be doing that at the same time you're trying to figure out where you're going to get your water supply from and what other gang is forming down the street and coming your way. And it goes to what you said when we talked last week, the whole gangs overtake other gangs based on what power they have, based on what technology they have. And so it's good to do that now to make sure you're the bigger of the fish in the nearby neighborhoods. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing to really think about is the resources you have and the resources that you need and, how you're able to protect what you have and how you're going to get what you need. And hopefully you can figure out a way to get what you need without having to, kill people for it. Hopefully you can keep some sort of a moral compass and, able to barter or make something with your hands or whatever it is, so you're not just going around killing people, but being able to defend your tribe, your family, whatever it is very important, and setting up networks and alliances with other groups in the area. It's only going to help you as long as you can all stay friends.
So speak to that a little bit. You've hinted that at a little bit. Tell it, and again, you've been all over the world. You've seen amazing things. You've seen heart-wrenching things. You've seen a whole spectrum of situations. Talk to a little bit about that. That whole, okay, you can put all the rules and bylaws and whatever you want on paper. And then there's the human element of just people are mean.
People are people.
And talk about, and I know that's really broad, but just what comes to your mind when I ask that?
Well, I think of when you talk about just different tribes and different, what different people are willing to do. And I think of Afghanistan, where you have the local Taliban farmers. That's all the Taliban really is the local farmers in the area that have their, you know, their tribe, their set up, you know, system of law and, you know, justice in their minds. But then you also have the foreign fighters from Pakistan or wherever they come from, a lot of them from the Haqqani network, that also have their own chain of command. And, you know, oftentimes, since, you know, they wield more money and more firepower, they control an area where, you know, the Taliban normally would control that area. Mm-hmm. And you'll see some areas that the Taliban plays nice with them, and they work together to fight, you know, the infidels, Americans, whatever. And there's other areas where you might be able to get, you know, those two forces to fight each other, and then you don't have to worry about fighting them yourselves. And mm-hmm. if you put that into a post-collapse type scenario, there might be a way that you can leverage your resources or, you know, something that you have to make one enemy tribe fight another enemy tribe where your people can stay out of the fight.
Boy, that sounds like political games that I've seen played here in the United States on headlines.
Does.
Oh my goodness, gravy. Oh, wow. So I just got chills at my spine listening to that. Thank you. So this is the next thing kind of on our list of things we want to talk about, a special forces doctrine on collapsing societies. Organized political violence. When I hear that, and just so our listeners, that we have a little bit of an outline we're following on this, because it's so easy to just go off and talk about so many things with someone like Special Forces Ted, which is great. But when I hear organized political violence, what I immediately think of is someone who used to live in Portland, Oregon. I just think Antifa. It seems to me when I watch Antifa work, and I've seen them work up close, is I feel like someone just threw gas on a situation and we're just watching the chaos that ensues from that. Somebody lit a fire. I don't know who. If you're reading the headline, I can take a pretty good guess and probably be pretty accurate. But it's also used very systematically, very organized. Like, for example, we just went through the holidays. There were no riots in Portland during kind of tick off everybody locally who's trying to shop in downtown Portland where, you know, all the Christmas lights aren't all that. They're not going to do that because it will turn the masses against them. So, you know what I mean? So I mm-hmm. see Antifa being used very, and so it's organized is what I'm saying. And there's a puppeteer and there's puppets in this. So you have ideas on this. And I know that, we're getting kind of up in the clouds a little bit, but that's where I kind of want to stay because it's something I just want people to be aware of. We don't need to dive down into the specifics, but what's the general idea about this sort of thing?
So you actually have to take a step back. If you look at organized political violence, that comes in the later stages of a possible insurgency or a resistance movement. And they can all happen somewhat simultaneously, but they don't necessarily have to all happen in the same order. But there's certain milestones, if you will, that you can look at to see kind of gauge where you're at in the certain level towards resistance or insurgency or, you know, phases of unconventional warfare. And, starting off at the very basic inception level, it's nothing more than, you know, discontent with the local policies, the local government, what's going on, you know, economically, what's going on politically in your area. People don't just one day wake up because they read something in the newspaper. The next thing you know, they're throwing Molotov cocktails. Mm-hmm. It escalates over time and over organization and other things, right?
Right.
So first would be discontent, I would think. And then after that, at the very, you know, grassroots level, it would be someone has to be behind this. There has to, you know, very rarely is it just, a mob that is coming together. You know, obviously Antifa is equipped and organized and funded. So there's someone who got them to that point. Mm-hmm. You know, so someone has created an atmosphere of discontent. Someone has fed them certain amounts of propaganda and spun current events, that are happening in the United States to meet their agenda. And, you know, whether it's, you know, saying Trump's a racist, even though they can't back it up or whatever it is.
Right.
Just to stoke the fire, you know. So there's definitely a lot of things that come into play before you start to see an active resistance such as Antifa. So, you know, you have people coming in financing mm-hmm. what's going on, people that are busing paid protesters into certain cities to protest. Obviously, that's happening now. So there's, you know, there's financier part of it. And there are
Soros.
George Soros definitely comes to mind. But one thing you have to think of is whenever you're looking at an insurgency or a resistance is who's going to take power. You need to have a political action arm that's going to be at the forefront of this. And is that political action arm Democratic Socialists? Is it the Muslim Brotherhood? I can't say. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that, you know, there has to be, at some point in time, there's going to have to, you know, be a political action arm that comes to the forefront after so much political, you know, discontent and violence happens to actually take lead and try to, you know, change laws and not just take ground, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's kind of, I don't know if that's too much in the weeds or too broad for you, but that's just
a
once around the world of kind of the way I see. And right now, as far as Antifa goes, I think they're probably, like, if I'm just looking this at, like, just, you know, broad strokes, broad strokes doctrine, they're on their way to, well, on their way to guerrilla activities, you know, political violence, sabotage, and, you know, guerrilla activities after that.
What does that look like, Special Forces? When you say Antifa guerrilla activities, what should folks that are listening be looking for as signs that this is unfolding like a classic resistance or insurgency?
Well, I mean, you could look at, you know, right now you're not going to see IEDs on I-5, you know, but within the next couple of years, that's a huge possibility. They're going to get more bold with the more support they get. So right now it may stick at hate protests, organized violence in certain areas, and you start seeing more, you know, propaganda trying to control the population or steer the population. And maybe, you know, interdicting military facilities, railways going into, you know, military plants, or, you know, companies, you know, taking political action towards companies that support the military. That's all part of, you know, subversion.
It's all part of Shelby's books, too.
I know. So I'm just sitting here like bursting at the seams because I have like, I want to back up just a little bit. So what I want listeners to hear, whether you live, I mean, if you follow me on social media, you know that I have got my laser attention on Portland, Oregon, because Antifa and what I'm going to say will harmonize very well with what you've just said. Antifa is allowed to grow. The mayor and the city council there do not hold Antifa accountable to the criminal activities when they are rioting, when they break windows, when they smash cars at car dealerships, and they cause millions of dollars in damage to public and private property. People are arrested, and they get three squares meals and a night in jail, and that's it. There's no holding them accountable. So they're allowed to grow. And so when you hear Special Forces say that, Ted say, that's further in the process. I hope that sends chills up everyone's spine, because Antifa is growing in Portland. And I also said recently, when we talked, Glenn and I talked at the very beginning of this podcast, what are things that I see coming up in the future? I said, I see Antifa incubating in other cities and starting their, you know, spreading their gospel of destruction. And sure enough, in Olympia, Washington, of all crazy places, aren't you glad you're not there anymore?
I'm very glad.
they are using, and you just said it, they're using the political climate that's happening and what's happening in the headlines. And I believe this. I believe homelessness is being used to leverage that very thing. And sure enough, in Olympia, Washington, in downtown, Antifa is allowed to grow, and they're leveraging the homeless issue to spread and to use it to commit violent acts. And to, at this point, they're really just kind of scaring people. They're really just kind of harassing very scarily. And so if you want to see all that, you can go check that out on social media in the last month or so, but they're growing. And so what, here's the thing. And it, if you live in Portland, Oregon, or in a stronghold of Antifa, and there's more, and it's more than just Portland, there's Seattle, there's San Francisco, there's, oh my gosh, Berkeley alone. What did you just heard him say? Next will be Molotov cocktails and IEDs on I-5. Holy crow. Now, I will point this out. In downtown Portland, Antifa has been known to throw Molotov cocktails into well-populated businesses that have not, we're not talking businesses like, you know, conference rooms for super rich corporate. No, we're talking Target stores that are full of families and children and people trying to shop for, you know, Christmas. That happened in the last couple of years. So what you're saying is happening, and it is part of kind of a prescribed typical way these political violence unfolds. So we as preppers, what would you, so on that note, what would you say to people who live in these unfortunate areas because of jobs or commitments or whatever? How can they prepare? I mean, is there a way? Is there anything they can do to protect their family? I'm not saying save the city, because you can't do that. But what can you do to save yourself and your family?
Well, as far as like talking about your family and yourself is, you know, keep your head on a swivel, stay vigilant, travel everywhere you can armed, and make sure that you have a plan wherever you go. You know, if we get separated, we're going to link up here, that type of thing. Yeah. But at a more regional level, you can always counter what they're doing with your own version of propaganda. And, you know, and spell out, you know, call them out for what they're doing and how it's wrong, and try to pull the center of gravity, the people, over to the side of against Antifa, instead of, you know, right now they're trying to leverage the homeless population and all that. Well, maybe you need to encourage the homeless population, get people in. Hello?
We're here. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, get people involved with setting up soup kitchens for the homeless, stuff like that, and show them another direction they can go instead of going to Antifa. You know what I mean?
Right.
And give them an out instead of just, because right now they're seeing the only people that are helping them is this organization that, you know, is doing political violence, and they're going to follow that. And if you can give these kids that are on the fence another direction to go, I think that would be a good thing.
So you mentioned that we're in a stage where we're going to see things like IEDs, and we're seeing bad stuff that Shelby was talking about. We're going to see more bad stuff. Play that out. What are some of the next steps in a typical collapsing government, and how would that apply to what we might see from Antifa, for example?
Well, so as far as the IED thing goes, I don't know if that's where we're at now. I'm saying that's the path that we're on. Obviously, if they're already, doing political protests with Molotov cocktails, there's nothing passive about it. And, they're rioting. They're rioting in the streets, right? Mm-hmm. So now they're going to go with more organized, directed type attacks, whether it's, a certain area, a certain district, a business district, whatever. But, you know, it could be burning down a building. It could be attacking people at their houses, you know, targeted, I don't know if it'd be as far as assassinations, but maybe that's all part of things under that, you know, that level of insurgency. And I don't know what textbook they're following, if they're following one at all. But I doubt they're coming up with all this stuff by themselves.
Right.
And the fact that the local government is more or less supporting them, either they're being useful idiots or they actually have an agenda of their own. Either way, it's someone needs to call them on what they're doing.
Interesting. So one thing I'll just, for our listeners, again, I watch this really closely. Really, because it helps. It's really great for. It's a great way to write fiction and add to a storyline. But I will say this, in the city of Portland, again, the mayor is very complicit with this. He requires the police force to stand down. There's some great videos out there of literally riding on one corner and a block away, the police are standing there, and it's sad. And to add to what you just said, these people have also come to the door at 4 o'clock in the morning of the mayor and pounded on his door and kind of gotten in his face and in his family's face and kind of stepped into his personal space, I guess. Mm-hmm. These things are happening. And so, I agree with you, there's something that behind this that is projecting it forward. And the idea is that it continues. They're not just going to stop here, even though there's these periods of time, I think, where Antifa stops. Again, the holidays, because that's how you keep the populace not on your side. There will be another issue that comes up. I will add this, though. Oh, my gosh, I keep losing my train of thought on this. There's a conservative group out there in the Portland metro area called Patriot Prayer, and it is run by a guy, and I forget his name, and it's a battle of the media. I don't know where I stand on what I think of Patriot Prayer, but they're the conservative side, and what they have done in Portland is, hey, we're going to have a prayer rally here in the middle of Antifa territory, essentially, and we're just going to stand here and pray. And I'll tell you what, riots have come out of that because Antifa shows up and it's just volatile. Mm-hmm. The media blames all of this on Patriot Prayer when it is Antifa who is doing the violence. So there's what you just described, this kind of battle of the hearts and minds of not only the media, but the locals is going on there. So what you've described is happening. And we only have a couple minutes before our break, but I want to give you the last couple minutes, especially for Ted, to just add any more thoughts to that.
Yes. So basically what I'll say is, to me, it sounds like the media in the Pacific Northwest is working as a psychological operations action arm for Antifa at this point.
Amen.
The way that you've described it to me. Hmm. And stuff like that, it's hard to say how you should handle it, you know, whether this Patriot Prayer group is doing it the right way or not. Mm-hmm. I'm not on the ground. I haven't really looked at it to really make an educated, call on it. But it's definitely a delicate situation that you really need to take a hard look at. And people should not just dismiss this, because it will grow and be out of hand sooner if you let it grow.
Wow. So did you want to add any thoughts to that before we take a quick break, Mr. Tate?
No, I'm just sitting here listening and thinking to myself, I have thought Antifa was somewhere on the spectrum of an organized group trying to overthrow the United States. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. And then to hear Special Forces Ted put it into the analytical tools that are typically used to assess whether things are a movement. By the way, we're not predicting, and I don't think Special Forces Ted is predicting, that Antifa in the next 3 hours is bayoneting everybody. No, I mean, we were just saying it's a process and that it's going on, and be aware, and it's a for real thing that's going on out there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Well, Ted, we have about a minute. Any wrap-up on Antifa thoughts before we go to our break?
Just, keep an eye on them, and if you see them in an area that you are, I would highly recommend getting yourself and your family out of there. Keep them safe and live another day to fight, the good fight.
Awesome. And that is a great note to take a break on. Catch you on the other side.
We'll be right back with more of Prepping 2.0 with authors Shelby Gallagher and Glenn Tate right after this.
Prepper Press is a small, independent publisher of survival nonfiction and post-apocalyptic fiction. At PrepperPress.com, you'll find a variety of books to guide you on your journey to prepare for a compromise to the electrical grid, natural disasters, economic collapse, political strife, or similar scenarios that could disrupt life as we know it. You'll also discover fictional yet believable stories about what happens to society when everything falls apart. To learn more, visit Prepper Press online at PrepperPress.com.
Do you need a custom Kydex holster or magazine holder? Glenn Tate's favorite custom holster and mag holder maker is Northwest Retention Systems. You can select your holster or mag holder color, including the I Miss America logo, and Northwest Retention Systems will custom make yours. While you're at it, look into the Scout Chest Rig Holster. Glenn loves his for vehicle operations and for fishing. Made by a young craftsman supporting a growing family of young patriots, Northwest Retention Systems products are 100% American-made with no foreign parts. Find out more online at northwestretentionsystems.com.
PrepperNet, where preppers unite. Looking to meet other like-minded people in your area? Looking to start your own prepper group? Already have a group? Join PrepperNet.com. PrepperNet has gathered the biggest names in the industry to help unite preppers everywhere. Join John Jacob Schmidt, Scott Hunt, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, Glenn Tate, Shelby Gallagher, Charlie Hogwood, Samuel Culper, Survivor Jane, Rick Austin, Franklin Horton, Ryan Mitchell, and Brian Duff. Our team is united. Check us out at PrepperNet.com. PrepperNet, where preppers unite. PrepperNet.com.
Hey everyone, are you a prepper who knows you need to have handheld radios for when you know what hits the fan, but you don't know anything about them? You don't want to learn complicated geek stuff or learn Morse code or all of that other useless information on a ham radio license test? You don't need another hobby and you don't need to buy things that you ultimately won't use. You just need to know how to use radios and which ones to get. Well, ham radio is for you. It's not ham radio, it's PAM radio. Prepper Amateur Radio. PAM. It's all the things preppers need to know to communicate on radios, but none of the stuff you don't need to know. PAM radio is a series of easy flashcards for your phone or laptop that teach you what kind of radios to buy and how far you can talk on them, with or without a ham radio license in some cases. It's not a prep course for your ham radio test. It's the practical stuff you need to know. Written by Glenn Tate, with input from members of the Special Operations Community, ham radio experts, and ham radio novices like you. These electronic flashcards will bring you up to speed so you can check radios off of your list of preps you need to take care of. PAM Radio is conveniently releasing in January 2019, so you can fulfill that ongoing New Year's resolution about getting up to speed on radios.
The Operator G1 is a full-featured, rugged comm solution designed for the Midland MXT 100 and 105. Designed and manufactured in the USA, the Operator is an all-in-one support platform for two-way wireless communication for civilians. Using the GMRS bands, there is no ham license required and no test needed for operation. Ideal for preppers, hunters, homesteaders, ranchers, and people just like you. Waterproof when closed, this rugged system houses the Midland radio, microphone, and antenna, providing an always-ready, always-charged grab-and-go solution for emergencies or events, as well as an ideal solution for a base station or vehicle use. Powered by a 60 Ah internal battery, the Operator recharges quickly and easily using the supplied AC charger, the internal solar controller, or directly from a vehicle. If you recognize the value of wireless communication with or without grid power, the Operator G1 is an award-winning solution that allows simple, one-button communication when it counts. Our two-year warranty, quality materials, and first-class assembly technicians deliver a high-value solution when you need to be sure you can get your comms up. To learn more, go online to portableuniversalpower.com.
And we're back with more of Prepping 2.0 with authors Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher.
Welcome back, everyone, from the break. This is Shelby Gallagher with my co-host, Glenn Tate, and our special guest. So cool to talk to someone like this, Special Forces Ted. Welcome back, Special Forces Ted.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So we kind of just were wrapping up the kind of steps, the spectrum of how political violence unfolds and leads to a collapse. But before we go any further, I know there's people in my books that are inspired by characters in my books that are inspired by real people. And you are a character in a book inspired, and you're the real person that inspired this character. So tell us, what does that feel like?
Yeah, it was a huge honor. I had no idea at the time. I had no idea about the books or anything. I had lost contact with pretty much all of my friends in Washington for a couple of years because I was deployed to various places pretty much for 2 years straight. So in 2014, spring of 2014, I get back from a long deployment, and I'm out to breakfast with some of our friends. Uh-huh. And Chip mentions me being Special Forces Ted. I'm like, what are you talking about? And And then Glenn's there at the table. We're all eating breakfast. And then it's like, oh, yeah, by the way, I wrote some books, dude, and you're in them. And I'm like, oh, no kidding. That's awesome. And, you know,
very cool.
And yeah, so I quickly got the books and read them and then read them again. And I mean, they blew me away. They were just so well written. So much information in these books. It's almost like a how-to guide for so many different aspects of prepping and collapse survival. And yeah, it was awesome. It's definitely an honor. And thank you so much.
Oh, you bet. I mean, how can I not? I've described this in other podcasts and interviews where I've said, I just know these amazing people and there's no rhyme or reason to why a suburban lawyer would know a special forces dude. And then it all connects into a story. Well, here's a question for you. Who was the first person you told that you were in a book, and what was the reaction?
So I think it was my wife, and I think my son was at breakfast with us that day, and we got home, and I think he told her, and she's like, what are you talking about? And then I went through the whole story about who you were and how I knew you and what these books were all about, and she's like, are you full of crap? You know, what's going on here? And, so then I got the first couple of books and started reading them. And, you know, she jumps on YouTube and starts looking you up, trying to figure out who you are, you know. And at the time, we're getting ready to move. I guess this might have been 2015. I don't know. The time kind of flew during that time period. But anyways, it was really cool. And she was definitely taken back and thought that I was just making up stories, and it turned out all to be real, so that's awesome.
Well, real in the sense that it's fiction, but yeah.
Well, yeah, right.
No, I know what you mean.
Yeah, well, exactly.
So now as you would read the books or listen to them on audio, whichever, were you sitting there thinking, well, that's a little different than real, and like, well, why did he say I'm from Oklahoma when you're mm-hmm. not? You're from the Midwest. I mean, what was going through your mind as you were reading these things, especially when it comes to little details?
Well, as far as the details, I realize that, you know, the character in the book isn't me exactly. It's, it's based off of me and who I am and things we've talked about. But, you know, the other nine books have nothing to do with actual reality, you know. So I know that, you know, it can't be me exactly. And, certain things, certain tactics, stuff like that. And, you know, certain things that, you know, almost SF Ted, you know, said this. I'm like, you know what? I don't know if I said that or not, but I probably would have said that. So that makes sense, you know. So, yeah, it was, you know, the information that you had in those books was very well thought out. Very impressed.
Hmm. Oh, thank you. It just flowed. Shelby, you have a comment to make.
I do have a question. So one of someone who knows me really well and knows me in real life read my first book and came back to me and said, he was kind of taken aback. And he said, I can't tell where fiction starts and reality is. You have blurred the lines between real instances and fiction, and it kind of scared him a little bit. Did you feel that way at all?
Yes and no. Like, obviously, I know that there's, you know, the streets of Olympia weren't burning down and stuff like that.
Right.
But everything was written in such a context that, you know, it was almost like it was happening as I was reading it, and in my head as I was reading the books. And then, you know, I'd stop reading the books and I'd start to look at what was going on outside, and I'm like, wow. You know, a lot of this is almost like a roadmap of what could be to come.
Yeah. Yep. That's go ahead.
Well, I'm just curious if any of your team guys, and I know you've recently had a you were stationed somewhere else, so it's not like your ODA, but I mean, do any of other dudes, you know, did you tell them you're in a book, or are you guys so modest that you really don't walk around like, yeah, I'm in a book?
Yeah. So initially I didn't tell anyone that I was in a book when I was at first group, just because I was afraid to see what the reactions that I would get. And I was leaving shortly after I found this out. I was PCS into the East Coast. So once I got to my duty assignment at Fort Bragg, I started talking to people and, you know, found out that I had a few coworkers that were preppers and into prepper fiction and stuff like that. And I turned them on to your books and, you know, eventually the conversation came up and I let them know, hey, this is based off of me. And usually it's like, oh, you're so full of crap. That's not you.
That guy's cool in the books. That's not you, right?
You know, exactly. You know, but then I would, you know, I would show them, you know, you have an autographed book that you gave me or whatever. And I'd show that to them and be like, no, really, dude, this is me. And, you know, they're like, oh, wow, that's awesome. Well, that's cool. You know, and then they just, you know, no one was like really starstruck or anything. It was more like, oh, cool. Let's get back to work.
Yeah.
Well, have you ever been in a situation, this probably hasn't happened, but I'll just see. Have you been in a situation where somebody said, hey, are you Special Forces Ted? Has that happened?
No, no one's ever asked me that.
Good, yeah. Your cover is still good. Yay.
That's right.
I don't normally run around just, you know, talking about, you know, anything openly unless I know someone. And if you saw me on the street, you would have no idea what I do for a living or what I did for a living.
And that's why your Special Forces Ted. Very good.
Not a SEAL.
So, okay, so kind of we're going to change directions here a little bit. And this is kind of picks up where we left off before the break. One of the things we want to ask you, and you in particular, because you're a prepper, you have life knowledge and experience that have equipped you for prepping that no one else has. It's very unique. And especially for as we kind of get off the topic of Antifa, I think it's so important. I tell people, if you live in one of those super dense urban environments that is very left-leaning in politics that allows these sorts of things to happen, you must have a bug-out plan. You cannot think that you're going to survive for very long hunkered down in your apartment. So that's my first prepping tip. But what would you tell people? Not only just post, you know, not just in Antifa, but good prepping tips. We'd love to hear some of your, how do you prepare?
Yeah, so as far as your bug out plan, I think no matter where you live, you need to be prepared to go somewhere. It's too easy for someone to burn your house down and then there goes everything that you've saved up, right? Mm-hmm. So definitely have a plan to go somewhere and have a you know, a route selection, have a what we call an EPA evasion plan of action on, you know, course of action one, and then resupply caches along the route, and have two or three different ways on how you're going to get to where you're going. And then, you know, have alternate locations as well. You know, it's sometimes it's hard to build that infrastructure right away, but you should constantly be, you know, planning out different routes and looking for new locations that can be, you know, a temporary safe house or, you know, a long-term, you know, destination. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as preparing, I think one thing that people, you know, really neglect is their individual training. You know, it's really easy to go on Amazon and buy a bunch of cool gear. It's real easy to buy stuff that you're into, like guns or, you know, whatever it may be. But to actually get trained on stuff and have the ability to make something happen with maybe not what's, you know, everything that's required to make that job happen. You know, being able to fix a car to make it work to get you to point A to point B. Or, you know, your firing pin broke in your gun. What are you going to use to make a new firing pin? Stuff like that. How can I, you know, get up on comm, set up a jungle antenna so I can get better communication with people? You know, how do I, you know, just there's a laundry list of things that people need to know how to do. And then everything else, the stuff, is just things that will make your job easier when you're trying to do it. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes tons of sense. That right there is the whole premise for Prepping 2.0. Am I right, Glenn?
Exactly. It's all about skills, and it's all about actually doing stuff. Prepping 1.0 is often about buying stuff, and that's good. It's good. Get a bunch of beans, get a bunch of rice, get an AR-15 or 10 or 20 or 30, or and that's good. That's your baseline. But to take it to the next level, You need to think about things that are outside your comfort zone. I'm not terribly mechanical. I've learned a fair amount about small engines, for example, electricity and those sorts of things, all of which are going to come in very handy, because the next level is increasing your odds and also being around, making it through for the restoration, so that this country will be restored by people like us who, quite honestly, are way better at it than goofball progressives. So, yeah, skills, absolutely. Well, speaking of skills, a team has more skills than one person. We are always asked this question,
always,
how to form a team. And recently, as Shelby mentioned earlier, now there's PrepperNet, which is out there, which is a really, really good way to start with this. How can regular people who don't hang out at First Group Special Forces, right? I mean, that you kind of an advantage you have there, Ted. Let's be honest. Yeah. I mean, you know people.
Right.
Regular people, and let's even take it one step farther. Regular people who don't happen to hang out at Capital City Guns like you and I did, and then, I mean, that was a huge leg up that we had. How do regular people form teams, and what should you be looking for on a team?
Well, I think above and beyond anything else, you need to be compatible with that person. Yeah, you have to, you know, if you're just on two different ends of the spectrum, there's no way, regardless of what skills you have, there's no way you're going to be able to work as a team. So, you know, you have to be compatible. You have to have, you know, somewhat the same beliefs and, you know, the same morals, because that's going to guide you throughout what you do and how you do it. After you get past that, then, you know, you need to start identifying who has access to what, who has knowledge of what, and who has the ability to help train other people. Just some people may know things, but they can't convey it to other people on how they know it and what to do. So being able to teach a skill is just as important as knowing the skill, I think.
Yeah, and I think that would be especially true. Well, it's true for teaching team members, but then I'm thinking about unconventional warfare and what you guys do, and you have to then teach others. I mean, it's great that you know comms. It's great that the guys on your team know comms, and I'm serious. That is good. What's really better is being able to teach basic comms to your neighbors, so they can tell you when the motorcycle gang is about to come through the neighborhood, you know, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, teaching the masses out there who don't know any of this stuff, because let's be honest, and you, Ted, you've probably been overseas for so long, you've probably sort of not seen this. We'll see. But I think that 99% of Americans don't know how to do anything when it comes to some of the skills we're talking about. And my point is there's going to be everybody that you're going to need to train. You're not going to have neighbors who are a bunch of SF guys, for example. You're going to have to train everybody in this stuff. Does that sound right?
Well, I think there's a huge divide in America, and a lot of that has to do with the capabilities and the lifestyle too. And I think the more rural you get with the people that you choose, the more skills they're going to have that are going to be more advantageous to what you're going to need during a collapse. I think that a lot of skills that the more urban people have, like, you know, how to use PayPal and or whatever they're, you know, whatever.
Dial it for Uber. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. How to get an Uber. All that stuff. You know, I mean, yeah, it's great. It's very convenient. But is it as convenient as how to chop logs the best way, but the most efficient way? How to store firewood for the winter? How to get the tractor running, how to plow a field, all that stuff. You know, things that, unless you're a working person that actually does it, you're not going to know how to do that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And you were mentioning rural versus urban, and that makes a ton of sense. What are some places, I mean, if you could move anywhere in the U.S., and this is people out there who are considering relocating, do you have some ideas about good parts of the country and bad parts of the country, and maybe some stuff that would surprise people? We all know Chicago's not the place to be, for example, but what are your thoughts on places to be when the S hits the fan?
So I look at it on several different levels. You know, I look at it like natural disaster wise, like I won't live in Florida because, you know, obviously you have hurricanes and, you know, stuff like that. I'm not going to move to Hawaii, you know, because of the threat, you know, of hurricanes or tsunamis or something like that. Or I'm not going to build a camp on Yellowstone because of the super volcano. You know, stuff like that, obviously. And then you have to think about natural terrain that's going to help you. You know, stuff like mountains, stuff that, you know, springs for water, fresh water, rivers, whatever. And then you have to think of being located to, like, you know, nuclear power plants, you know, things that can melt down and cause their own trouble for the area. And also high population centers of people that will easily become a problem for you if you're around them. I would say anywhere along the Appalachian Mountains would probably be pretty good. Parts of the Cascade. I really like the idea of Liberty State. It is kind of close to Yellowstone, though, so I don't know.
Heck yeah.
That one's for you, Representative Matt Shea, soon to be, hopefully, governor of the Liberty State. That's awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah, I really like the idea of that. And really, it's surrounding yourself by, you know, with like-minded people, you know, in a geographical area, but also having an area that will provide for you, and not only with food, but also with possible defenses.
Absolutely. One of the things we talk about on Prepping 2.0, some examples of what we're talking about are water, which seems to always be overlooked, which is hilarious. I mean, not hilarious, it's tragic, you know, because it's a lot less cool to talk about, you know, water filters than, again, that $400 trigger for your seventh AR-15. We talk about comms as being that next step, and community being the next step. And I think we've covered that. But here's one very specific thing that I bet you have some thoughts on, and that's night vision. And describe to people how much of an advantage night vision is, and maybe some examples of that, because I don't think people out there, until they strap one of those on and actually use it and can experience it, I don't think you can understand what a big deal it is. So it's cheating. Tell me about night vision.
Yeah. Night vision is an absolute game changer. It's a must for your perimeter defense and just, you know, nighttime food gathering, whatever you want. You know, you will literally own the night with night vision. And, you know, you have infrared laser aiming devices and, you know, so many other things. If you don't have night vision in your preps, it's something that you definitely need to get. And I understand batteries are an issue, but you can have rechargeable batteries, solar panels, you know, whatever, to keep those systems up and running. But if someone's going to come at you that has night vision and you don't have it, you're going to get hit hard at night when you don't expect it, and you're never going to see them coming. It's one of those things that it's not I can't get it because it's too expensive. It's one of those things you need to make a priority. I really do feel that way.
Well, and I'm going to add this to that, because Glenn and I absolutely agree with you, and if you've ever used it, it's true. You feel like you're cheating, you know, when you can see a critter way out there several yards away from you, and it doesn't even know that you're there. And same thing with a person, same thing with an adversary. It feels like cheating. Here's the thing I want to throw out there. Again, I'm going back to what we talked about before the break, the whole Antifa thing and how well-funded they are. Guarantee that is on their list of equipment. So if you live in an urban environment, it's something to consider when you think about how that progression of the political violence is going to continue. And that will be a game changer for them. It will give them the advantage. But also, too, and I like what you said earlier, because I agree, there's a huge divide, having now lived some of my life in an urban environment and some in a rural environment. Different ideology. People think very differently. They have different skill sets, different priorities. If you lived out in the country, I'm just going to say it, it's dark. You do not have city streetlights. It's dark. Unless the moon is out. And I actually bring this up in my one of my books, where there's a person standing in the dark of night listening to another conversation literally just feet from them, and they don't know this person's there because it is dark. Dark, when you close your eyes and open your eyes, are the same. So if you live in the city and you're listening to me, you do not understand dark until you understand no electricity kind of dark. And think about the last time electricity went out or whatever. And imagine the advantage an enemy will have with night vision and you don't have it. So there's that. Any more thoughts on that, Glenn or Special Forstead?
Well, one thing I'd like to add to that is thinking back to Afghanistan, especially in the early days, the Taliban wouldn't normally attack you at night unless it was during a full moon cycle. They'd never attack you if the, you know, if there was no moon or half moon. But as soon as it was a full moon, I guarantee you that the fight was on. And that's because they didn't have night vision. But even when they came at us with their full moon, we would dominate because we had the night vision. And it really was a game changer on the battlefield.
Wow. Go ahead. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, did the Taliban ever get night vision, or some of the foreign fighters, some of the stuff?
Absolutely. Later on, nowadays, and, as recent as 2013, 2014, you would start to see, some night vision, some laser aiming devices, stuff like that, on targets. And it's one of those things, you'll see foreign fighters with body armor. That stuff, it's making its way to the battlefield, and it's been there for, in some cases for a while. I think in Syria and Iraq, it's probably more prevalent than, in Afghanistan. But you're going to see it. Anything you can buy on the internet, you're going to see on the battlefield for sure. Yeah.
And here's a classic question. We have about 5 more minutes in this segment. What are your favorite and least favorite MRE meals?
you're going to be really surprised at this, but I don't eat a lot of MREs. I haven't since I joined Special Forces. Most of our meals are on the economy with the people, eating what they eat type of deal. And very rarely am I actually opening up a brown bag to dig chow out. If I'm on patrol with my indigenous people and they stop for food, if they're eating goat, I'm eating goat, whatever it turns out to be.
I did not know that. And earlier in the previous episode, we were talking about the goat circuit and eating goat and everything. And I thought that was an unusual one-off thing. But yeah, it would make sense that you guys would eat what the locals are eating, because one of the things that's really embarrassing, it's really offensive. Even when you go to somebody comes to your house, right? They come to your house and they're like, oh, that's not the food we eat. And it's like, really? Well, what's wrong with you? So you would want to have it on a bigger scale. What's the most interesting person you ever worked with, say on an ODA?
I mean, there's so many colorful personalities on an ODA. You'll have people from all walks of life. I don't know if I can say any one most interesting. I would definitely have to think about that for a while. Yeah, no one just kind of shoots up. Everyone's very unique and special in some way. It's weird.
Yeah. Well, would you advise, let's say teenagers out there, younger folks, do you think going into the U.S. military is a good idea now with, the president we have? Is that good or bad? I think I know the answer to that. Some of the wars that, special operations is tasked with fighting. What would be your advice to somebody who's thinking about going into the military or not, or to a parent who's thinking about either letting or not letting their kid into the military, especially the special operations community?
So I think, at the basic level, service to your country is an important thing. With that said, I don't think it's for everyone. And it shouldn't be something someone does just to pay for college, especially going into special forces or special operations. You definitely, it's some next level stuff where you're definitely going to be in harm's way. And there's easier ways to pay for college than, getting shot at and blown up and having to shoot people. So, I would definitely rethink that. The only reason you want to do it is pay off college. I definitely, I have some opinions about, the current situation of the military, but, that's not the soldier's fault. That's the politician's fault. And, it is what it is. I think in the long run, a lot of this is going to end up hurting people and, on the battlefield and whatnot. But, as far as serving your country, I think everyone can serve their country, maybe not necessarily having to join the military, but, serve their community in a certain way or however. But there are those certain people that have the calling, and if they feel they want to try out for special forces or special operations, if they're doing it for the right reasons, I think they should try, because they'll probably be asking themselves for the rest of their lives, could I have done it? So, yeah, give it a try if that's something you really need to do. But I think it's a very individual and personal, you know, thing. I don't think there's a cookie cutter answer. Everyone's a little different.
Wow. Thank you so much. That is a great note. We have to kind of wrap up here. That's a great note to end on, Special Forces Ted. And thank you. We cannot thank you enough for giving us so much of your time and so much of your insight to these issues that are so important to us. And again, wish you luck, and we'll be in touch. And for those of you who are listening, thank you so much for joining us this week on Prepping 2.0. Come back again soon.
You've been listening to Prepping 2.0 with authors Shelby Gallagher and Glenn Tate. All of the fun and easy prepping information heard on this podcast can be found online at prepping2-0.com. You can also find out more about Glenn's books online at 299days.com and about Shelby's books online at agreatstate.com. Until next time, be smart, be safe, and be prepared.